Ladies and gentlemen, please join me, along with the delegation from the great state of Georgia, in welcoming the mayor of the greatest city in the world, Atlanta, Georgia, Mayor Andrew Young. Mr. Chairman, distinguished delegates, friends, and ladies and gentlemen, I'm very pleased to be here with you, not because I see this as a mock convention, as you call it, but because I see this as a prophetic convention. I see you as helping our nation and our party determine not only who the next nominee of the Democratic Party will be, but I see you helping to formulate the opinions that will make the nominee of this convention not only the nominee of our party, but the nominee and the next president of the United States of America. I am a Democrat. I am a Roosevelt Democrat. I'm a Roosevelt Democrat not by choice, but frankly by birth. I was born in 1932, and anybody down south that had any sense was a Roosevelt Democrat, because that was the salvation of our Southland. I'm now the mayor of one of the fastest growing cities in the world. In the past 5 years, the city of Atlanta has created 670,000 new jobs and attracted over $52 billion worth of new investment. That's a greater record of jobs growth and economic development in one southern city in the state of Georgia than in the entire European community during a similar five-year period. And the reason we were able to do that is not because of my leadership, but because of the foundation that has been laid in this southern part of the United States through the Tennessee Valley Authority and a New Deal under Franklin Roosevelt, through land-grant colleges and agricultural and health extension services, through programs of rural electrification, through a dramatic highway system, and through now building a mass transit system that connects our entire metropolitan area with the busiest and best airport anywhere in the world. I say that not just to brag on Atlanta, but simply to remind us that wherever there is success in these United States, there is a record and a tradition of democratic leadership. And that's what I see terribly missing at present. I happen to be represented in the Congress of the United States, elected in 1973, and I sat on the Banking Committee as Richard Nixon sent his Secretary of Treasury to announce to the Banking Committee that the dollar was going to be allowed to float. It was going to seek its own level. We were just going to see what was going to happen. What they did, in effect, was abandon a tradition of democratic leadership, not only of the nation, but democratic leadership of the entire free world. Because they abandoned the system which was formed after the Second World War, which made it possible for Europe to develop, it made it possible for Japan to develop, it kept currency rates low, stable, and it kept interest rates low, it made available technology and capital to the entire free world, and it created the prosperity and the progress that all of us have come to enjoy. But it required leadership. It required American vision. It required the investment of American talents. It required us sitting together saying to the Europeans, saying to the Japanese, saying to Koreans and Brazilians and Nigerians, saying to the Soviet Union and the East European bloc, that we were going to show them how to put together an economy that could feed the world, that could house the world, that could clothe the naked, and that could heal the sick. And so over a period of time, you saw democratic leadership giving the world hope, giving the world prosperity, giving the world a challenge to freedom that has been unparalleled by any similar period in the history of this small planet of ours. But when we broke up that agreement, when we pulled back from that leadership, when we forgot that nothing happens in this world except American vision, American dedication, American commitment to the least of these God's children all over the planet. Nothing happens for good unless we as a nation are involved in it and unless we as a nation are giving it leadership. And so when we abandoned our leadership role, we saw OPEC formed. We saw the price of oil go up from about $2.50 a barrel to $4.50, and then all the way up to about $40 a barrel. And we saw an economic shock across the world that created chaos in the markets of the world, that left American workers unemployed. And we found that the only nations that were able to make it in the world were those nations that we had given a special edge to. Namely the Europeans and the Japanese, whom we subsidized after the war. We made it possible for them to have low interest loans to develop a steel industry. But then we said to the Ohio and the Pennsylvania steel industry, you can't have the same low interest loans that the Japanese and the Europeans have. You have to have market rate loans because we're letting everything float now. We said to the American farmer, we can't give you the same security that the Japanese government gives the Japanese farmer. We can't give you the same security that the European farmer gets from the European community. You've got to go it on your own. And so after American taxpayers had created a world that was safe and secure for people who had been their enemies, their own government denied them that same security under the guise of a kind of Republican laissez-faire distortion that they seem to call freedom. And so I say to this convention that we've got to restore to this nation and to the world in which we live the concept of responsible leadership, the concept of a freedom which essentially is freedom not to take from the world and not to take from the poor, but a freedom to give the best of our resources, the best of our talents, and the best of our vision to the people in the world who need it most. And so I'm expecting this convention to nominate a president that will restore that tradition of democratic leadership. We also have to take a look at what it means for a nation to be strong. Everybody believes in a strong America. Everybody in the world wants a strong America. Even the people who consider themselves our adversaries know that they are better off. Even in the Soviet Union, they're better off if America is strong. Because even in the Soviet Union, they need the strength and integrity of a strong America to keep some of their own militants from doing things that are crazy, that they don't control because of the sterility of their own system. The Japanese government needs a strong America, because the Japanese government could not survive if it did not have America to protect them and their access to the markets of the world. The Europeans need a strong America, for their economy could not thrive if it could not send so many of its goods and services into this, the greatest economy in the history of humankind. But it is not for them to decide what is a strong America. It's for us to decide what is a strong America. It's for us to understand that a strong America is, first of all, an educated America. It's for us to understand that the best thing we can do for the world is to maintain the caliber of university education, to maintain the kind of creativity and freedom for anybody in this country to get all of the education that their minds can absorb at prices that their pocketbooks can afford. And when their minds are stronger than their pocketbooks, it is the experience of the United States of America that the best investment we can make as a nation is an investment in a university or graduate education. That when we invest $4,000 or $5,000 or $6,000 a year or $10,000 a year, we're preparing people who will pay that money back, not only repaying the loan, but they will repay that money back to the economy through the taxes and contribution that they will make to the growth and development of this nation for us all. And so an educated America is a strong America, an America that uses its moral power and its diplomatic power before it uses its military power, an America that uses its old men's talents before it commits its young men's lives. That's a strong and wise America. And so I say to you that the next president of these United States is going to bring that concept of strength, a strong people, and a strong diplomacy, as well as a strong economy, to bring back once again the leadership of America, not only to the American people and her needs, but to the needs of the people of the entire planet on which we live. Now, these are not going to be easy days, and we remember John Kennedy saying, ask not what your country can do for you, but ask what you can do for your country, as the kind of challenge that Americans will respond to. What we're doing here is not having a popularity contest. What we're doing is we're electing the chief executive officer of a trillion-dollar corporation. And unfortunately, that trillion-dollar corporation, thanks to the leadership of Ronald Reagan, is $2 trillion in debt. That trillion-dollar corporation continues to run a trade deficit in excess of $150 billion. That family corporation, that trillion-dollar family corporation, indeed is in serious danger of some kind of leverage buyout or takeover, unless we elect somebody who can lead with vision, but who is capable of managing that vision, unless we have somebody who is able to give us dreams, but not feed us on ideology that has no practical sense. We have the responsibility to take seriously the business of this country. For if there is not solvency in the business, if the business is not healthy, if the business is not producing jobs, if the business is not growing, if the business is not satisfying the needs of its consumers or citizens, then the business is not going to be able to give leadership to the world in which we live. And so this is serious business. The business of electing the next president of the United States of America. And I don't know that there has ever been in any period in history a finer collection of candidates who have offered themselves for public office and for the office of the presidency than the candidates that you represent as delegates to this convention. I don't know that there's ever been a time in my lifetime that I have felt more comfortable with more candidates in our party, that they are men of intelligence, they're men of integrity, they're men of vision, they're men who have demonstrated in the course of their public and private lives their concern for the country and their concern for the needs of the people of this country and the world. You have amongst your candidates the kind of representative that the world needs to give leadership for the next 4 years. And so I trust you. I trust you to give our party the leadership that it needs. For we have come a long, long way in our lifetime. I went to college not far from here, right up the road in Washington, D.C. And going back home to my hometown of New Orleans, Louisiana, as a recent graduate, there were many places in this native Southland of mine that I was afraid to stop. I was very nervous when I got to the state of Georgia in 1952. For the state of Georgia wasn't exactly a safe place for a young black man to be riding alone at night. And so I really turned around and went back to South Carolina and got gas. I didn't even want to stop in Georgia at a gas station. And I didn't stop again until I got to Alabama, because Georgia seemed to me to be one of the worst places in the world for somebody black. And yet if somebody had said to me then, son, you better slow down in Georgia. You're going to be a congressman from Georgia one of these days. And a Georgian governor is going to be elected president of the United States. And that South Georgia governor is going to ask you to go to represent your country at the United Nations. And then you're going to come back from the United Nations, and the people of the city of Atlanta, this sleepy southern town, are going to elect you, a black man from the South, as mayor of that city. That was inconceivable. It was incomprehensible. None of us could have believed it. And yet I think even as I can say that is my story, there is in this audience, and there is among the parents of people here, a similar story of progress and prosperity as a result of working together in the greatest nation in the history of the world in which we live. And so I leave you with the words of the Reverend James Cleveland, a modern spiritual and gospel song. Words of challenge for the future, which say very simply, Lord, I don't feel no ways tired. We've come too far from where we started from. And nobody ever told us that the way would be easy. But I don't believe he brought us this far to leave us. We have a long, long way to go, in spite of the fact that we have all come further in our lifetimes than we ever would have imagined possible. And yet in my decade, we came that far without television, without computers, without transcontinental telephone lines, without supersonic jets. We were able to hold the world together and almost make a way out of no way without any of the advanced technology which you and your generation take for granted. If we were able to do so much in the last 25 years, how much more are you going to be able to do in the next 25 years? And how much more? And how much more is the next president of the United States going to be able to do for the American people, be able to do for the free world, and be able to do for the progress and prosperity of all of those people on this planet in which we give leadership? Thank you very much. Elect a president and bring us a winner to Atlanta.
Thank you, Mayor Young. The chair now recognizes Mr. Paul Miles for the report on the platform.
Ladies and gentlemen, and